The Old Testament book of Nehemiah, chapter 6, and we look at the first 14 verses in which Nehemiah, God's builder over 24 centuries ago, finds himself once more facing opposition. Maybe actually we should start at verse 3 of chapter 6, where we read the words of this servant of God as he replies to an invitation to meet and parley with his critics. Verse 3, Nehemiah records, "So I sent messengers to them with this reply, 'I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop?'" And of course there have been others since then who've refused to be deflected from the big thing that they were called to do in their life. Many have been like that. Many in Christian work. I think of the remarkable evangelist of over a century ago from America, D.L. Moody. And in San Francisco in the late 1880s, as one of his campaigns was about to begin, there was a professional photographer by the name of George B. Ryman. And he offered to take Moody's photograph for the newspapers in that city because he wanted to add Moody to his collection of actors, politicians, and other notables. Moody declined with thanks for the offer of a free sitting, saying that he had come to San Francisco not to have his photograph taken, but to save Ryman's soul. And Ryman was beside himself with fury. But on the last day of the campaign, he and his wife did in fact attend the meetings at last. And after the sermon and after meeting was announced, and George Ryman said to his wife, "Well, we've been to the circus, let's go to the sideshow also." And in that follow-up meeting, two helpful Christian workers met with them and introduced them both to the person and to the claims of Jesus Christ. And Ryman eventually became an outstanding Christian preacher himself on the Pacific coast. Well, supposing Moody had said, "Oh, okay, I'll have my photograph taken," I think they'd have lost that preacher on the Pacific coast. But he held to the main thing. He did really a Nehemiah. When there's a great work taking place, other claims have to take second place. That's the lesson that we learn from Nehemiah. Think of Michelangelo, that great Italian artist of the 15th century. He was unable to stop his work of painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, even for a change of clothes. He just kept on at it. Or you think of the musician, Handel, who couldn't stop for anything while he was composing the greatest oratorio of all time, The Messiah, in a breathtaking 23 days. Our study today is about the Jewish governor Nehemiah of the 5th century B.C. His actual job had been that of butler, serving the wine to the most important man in the world, King Artaxerxes of Persia. But no, there was a greater work that called Nehemiah away from Susa, the capital of the world. And it was the divine mega drama of reconstructing not just the walls of broken down Jerusalem, but the morale, reconstructing the spirit, the very life of the people of God. And always, though we may find it difficult to believe, what is happening to the church, those whom God has called out to be his people, is of more importance to the world than what is happening to any other group. You read the newspapers, you'll never believe that. But we may believe it. The church, or as in the case of Nehemiah, its ancestors, the Jews, downtrodden, a minority, a bunch of exiled serfs, first of Babylon, then of Medo-Persia, the conqueror of Babylon. A nothing people, a prison people. And Nehemiah was one of them, born in captivity. He'd never even seen Jerusalem. But now, with the ending of the days of exile and the increasing return of the Jews at last to their homeland once again, Nehemiah, the butler, has by divine summons become Nehemiah the builder. It's a higher calling. So Handel completed the music of the Messiah in 23 days. Nehemiah and his energetic colleagues were going to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. The walls of Jerusalem, have you ever seen them? They're enormous. It actually took them 52 days. But we can be quite sure, wherever we see the work of God surging to the front, the devil, the powers of darkness, won't be far behind. I think of the days of reconstruction of Uganda. After the Tanzanian campaign that finally toppled the dictator Idi Amin those few years ago. You know, the first convoy over the border into liberated Kampala was from an organization that I'm the UK chairman of, African Enterprise. Not that I had much to do with that convoy, nothing to do with it. But it was a Christian mission agency bringing in that first convoy after the coup, bringing in blankets, clothing, medicine, milk powder, food, help. You know what? The second convoy over the border, you know where it came from? What was then the Soviet Union. And that convoy was crammed with guns. It's always the same. Something that is good, beneficial, followed by something that is on the other side. The rider on the white horse in the book of Revelation, representing Christ, gallops out onto the stage of world history. But then following next on his heels is the red horseman in that vision, representing the forces of war and slaughter. That's in Revelation chapter 6. Here is Nehemiah. A great work is in process. There's no time to lose. The work has started. The project is on. And then, bang, the opposition raises its head as early as chapter 2 in the form of Sanballat and his colleague Tobiah. They take note of the rebuilding activities. And by chapter 4, they're marshalling their forces to stop the work, if necessary, by force. That's why Nehemiah and his companions mount a guard, day and night. In fact, they do a sort of Michelangelo. They never even stop for a change of clothes. Chapter 4, verse 23. Then, in chapter 5, the danger rises up from within in the form of internal division. Until with resolve and prayer, it's resolved. Until that happens, not a brick is laid. Brings the work to a standstill, just division. Now by chapter 6, the work has been resumed. All the gaps in the wall are filled. Only the gates are missing. And then, bam! It's Sanballat again, along with Tobiah once more, and Geshem the Arab, there in verses 1 and 2. This whole study, verses 1 to 14, is taken up with an account of their tactics. So verse 1 and 2, when word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message, come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. I tell you, friends, it's never been different. You reach a point when you think that you've won the battle against the enemies of God's work, and then a little later, bam, you find yourself on the same battlefield, all over again, the same enemies. Once you've stuck your head up over the parapet, once you've made it plain, publicly, that you've taken sides, philosophically, spiritually, for Jesus, for the kingdom of God, that you're standing for the gospel and for him and for an unchanging standard of truth and morals and sexual purity and financial honesty, once we involve ourselves actively in the work of God's kingdom, expect trouble and opposition. It's not abnormal. Don't be surprised when it happens. It began for Nehemiah back in chapter 4 on the populist level, of the sort of the cartoon level, really. turning the work into a joke. It was one great big laugh. That's how Sanballat decided to cast it. Very funny. Look at these Jews. And that's one obvious approach that has been used all down history. First of all, to deride them. Just to deride the work of God. It was all in those early verses of chapter 4 when Sanballat ridicules the Jews, and then Tobiah boasts that those pathetic walls wouldn't even stop a fox. You ever been ridiculed for being involved in Christian work? I expect most of us have at some point. I think of a man called John Ingram. I was at University of Cambridge with him. And one day we and the Christian group decided to put on an open-air meeting. We were just undergraduates. And we selected John Ingram because he was big and tall and imposing. He looked pretty good. He was an athlete. And he represented the university, and he had the Hawks tie on. We dressed him up in the Hawks tie, which indicated that he was a member of the elite, you know, sportsman's group in the university. And we got him up, and we thought, he looks pretty good. He'll do us well. Then I heard the laughing going on. We were just by the University Arms Hotel on the banks of the River Cam. You know, you could hear it. Just look over there. Look, it's the God Squad. How nauseating. It's my first taste. You ever been on the end of that yet? Expect more. That's one obvious method. Deride them. And then they're here in chapter 6. There's a second. Distract them. It's quite simple, really. Chapter 6, in verse 2, Sanballat and Geshem, come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Very simple. You see the reasoning behind it. Could we have a meeting? Just to talk? We'd like to set up a conference just for an exchange of views. Won't do any harm. A discussion. We're only going to talk. Just talk. But Nehemiah sees through the tactic and he sends back his crisp message at the end of verse 3. I am carrying on a great project. I cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? So often been the same. Let's talk about it. I see Jesus in the wilderness, in that temptation recorded in Matthew chapter 4. And there is Satan, the tempter, trying to talk him over. Jesus, you're weak. Wouldn't you like to have more on your side? Armies and navies, banks and businesses? Why, I've got the power to give you all of that in exchange for one little bow to me. That's all. Like to talk about it, Jesus? Shall we do a deal? But Jesus won't have any of it. Satan, I didn't come to join you. I came to beat you. Get out. Nehemiah has something of that spirit. I'm not joining you in the plain of Ono. Because we've got rather a big work going on right here, which I'm involved in. But Sanballat and his friends, they won't accept this straight refusal. Derision hasn't worked. Distraction hasn't worked. Then let's exhaust them. That's the third ploy. Verse 4 gives us the clue here. Four times they sent me the same message. Each time I gave the same answer. Four times. If possible, this is the reasoning, let's wear Nehemiah out by our repeated approaches. Perhaps he'll cave in eventually and agree to come and talk. Keep on at him. Come on. It was a modern day Christian leader and mission statesman, Max Warren, who once wrote, "What worries me about so much Christianity is that it leaves me with the impression that people aren't wrestling, but are resting on the thrill of not having been thrown in the first round." And once we embark on this thing called the Christian faith, and we're convinced that it's true, with Jesus as the great magnet who pulls us on, we shall find that there's decision after decision to be made again and again to take his side, not the other side. We may think we've gained a great victory one day. There will have to be another battle another day. It's all very well to have made a good start, but life with God involves round after round with the unseen powers of darkness and temptation and the devil and the world and the pull of London all around us. All of that. And when, as sometimes takes place, someone in Christian work perhaps is involved in a scandal and an expose takes place, maybe in the newspapers if the person is prominent, maybe a financial problem or sexual or on some other point of ethics, invariably there has been a build-up beforehand, it appears. Maybe over many months. Months of just compromising, caving in, and nobody knew a thing about it. Not even the family or the spouse. And then suddenly, it's in the newspaper. What has happened? Why, the individual concerned has simply got tired of repeatedly taking sides, of resisting the temptations, the blandishments, the offers. The first time, it was hard. After that, it got easier. In this instance, the opposition believed that it could exhaust Nehemiah's moral resolve and undermine his resistance. But no, he outlasted them. And so can we. The prophet Daniel writes of the formidable body of opposition that for all of time is ranged against the people of God. This personal being who, in Daniel 7 verse 25, is said to speak against the Most High and to wear out the saints. And that's what will be done, if it is possible, just to wear us out. We're part of this age, and it's a long kind of pressurizing campaign that we should find ourselves in. We shouldn't be surprised to find ourselves in such a situation. Actually, it's quite a good sign when we find the pressure mounting, maybe in the place of work or study, maybe within the family, where we've taken sides for God and for goodness and the kingdom of Christ. When we're aware of increasing pressure, it's not a bad sign. It's a surefire indication that we have changed sides and decided for Jesus Christ and his kingdom. But those are some of the ploys. Deride them. Try that. Distract them. Exhaust them. And if all of those fail, why, there's a fourth here in Nehemiah 6. Intimidate them. I'm looking at verses 5 to 7. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his assistant to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter. So it's an open letter, in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There's a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king. So come, let us confer together." Intimidate. The opposition knew very well that the nations were looking hard at what was happening there in Judah with the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. All eyes were on Judah. What's happening there? And if that work could be brought down, then the triumph would be immense. Intimidate them. The ploy of this unsealed letter, the open letter, and behind it is that threat of informing the public, and in particular King Artaxerxes, that Nehemiah and friends are planning a kind of political coup to get Jerusalem built in order to set up a rival kingdom. So runs the argument. In view of this open, this leaked document, wouldn't it, after all, dear governor, be a good idea to set up an all-party conference and confer together? You don't want rumors like this getting back to the palace, do you? The direct threat, intimidate them. Perhaps we don't have very much of this in the West, though we do at times. There will be some people in church here who get direct intimidation from their place of work if you start to stand up for the things that you know are proper and right, and in accordance with righteousness. There will be people who are suffering from that right now. And why we come to church? To be strengthened in our resolve. In many parts of the world, that's the norm. You think of the countless Christian martyrdoms that took place in the 20th century, more than in all the other centuries put together. At least 300,000 Sudanese Christians were killed between 1982 and 1996. Not that intimidation ever wipes out the Church of God. If only those who oppose the Kingdom of God realized that, I suppose they'd be more cautious before they started persecuting people of faith and love. I can think of the various countries where they persecute the Christians, and then we watch the church grow as a result. It's almost uncanny. In Nigeria, where the going has been rough for parts of the Christian church, there are more Anglican worshippers today than in all of Britain, Europe, and America combined. Nehemiah knew the secret of not being intimidated by threats. He flatly contradicts the claims of the spurious document in verses 8 and 9. I sent in this reply, "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed. Now strengthen my hands." There's the way of derision, of distraction, of exhaustion, of intimidation. Is there a fifth line of attack? There is. It's in verse 10 onwards. When all else fails, then fifthly, you can contain them. Or at least attempt to contain them. Containment is how I tend to interpret the attack on the work described in verse 10. "One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Metadabi, who was shut in at home. He said, 'Let us meet in the house of God, inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you.' But I said, 'Should a man like me run away?'" So the idea, as Nehemiah tells us in verse 13, was to get him, Nehemiah, to flee from assassination by taking refuge in the temple. That would give Nehemiah a bad name for getting the temple closed and the worship shut down. To use the temple as a fortress. It would also bring the work of restoration to a standstill by containing its leader. And containment is one of the best of all the devil's tricks. When God's work is safely contained, you can have as much worship as you like. You can preach sermons. You can sing choruses till they're coming out of your ears. But they'll never do any damage in the place where it really matters, out there in the public arena. Because the Christian's work, the church's work, is buttoned up within the walls of its buildings. We can apply that to our workplace. When you think of verse 11, "Should a man like me run away?" It is possible to run away from the witness in the place where it really matters by saying, "Well, I'll wrap myself up, of course, in my fellowship group, in my Christian activities, in that Sunday school work, in the choir work, whatever it may be. I'll wrap myself up in my church work and forget really about my responsibilities in the workplace." So the reason why we have this workplace ministry here at this church, when on Tuesday mornings, men and women in the workplace get to breakfast here, Bible breakfast, they call it. Bible and breakfast together. Just to fortify each other's morale in the place out there in the arena to help them not to run away, but to face up to the responsibilities and then to find comfort in each other and in the scriptures and in prayer together. It's a wonderful thing to do. So there's Nehemiah. "Should a man like me run away?" He's not going to do that. And when there's somebody in the workplace or in the study place who's bearing that witness for God and for truth, others will notice. I remember going to a cocktail party some time back, and there was a young man there, and I got talking with him, and it appeared that he was not a Christian at all. So I said, "So what brings you here to this get-together? "Oh," he said, "it's because of," and he pointed, "it's because of him. He pointed across the room at a man with specs, who was a student. He said, I have watched him. And I noticed that there's something quite different about his whole manner of life. And I wish I had got what he has. So I've come because of him. That's why I'm here. It is noticed. What is going on across Europe today on a much wider front is the containment of the church. Of course, the church can operate. This is the way that it's framed. Of course the church can operate, but we must keep it away from the media, keep the church influence out of the theatre, keep it away from the TV and radio, unless, of course, there's a scandal, in which case, then it can have front page coverage. It remains to be seen if the church's message through the internet can in the end leapfrog all of the existing media over the next few years. But it was a well-tried policy of communist states for many years. Bottle up the church inside its walls. Yes, it can be allowed to meet. That'll show that we've got freedom of religion. But that's all. It's contained. Here in verse 10, get Nehemiah, the ringleader, away from the action and into the temple building and contain him there. Derision, distraction, exhaustion, intimidation, and then containment. Why did they all fail? Well, it only takes one person with a sense of calling, with a clear vision and discernment to stand up where others might give way, to refuse to give ground, to see through the lies, to expose the false arguments, and with a firm grasp upon the past, to rekindle the line of collective memory within one's own people. It's when an entire society is suffering from a loss of collective memory, and I suppose that plenty of today's leaders seem to fall into that category, that a people can be taken for a ride, no matter who is at the driving wheel. Nehemiah is good for his people because he keeps reminding them about the covenant and about the past, and God's working in the past, and their history, and their heritage. He keeps reminding them of that. We are God's people. And he's good medicine for us in the 21st century. So when we see work that is being done that is good, connected with the gospel, we want to get behind it. I think of the clubhouse, the All Souls Clubhouse. I was there this morning for their service, and then into lunch, and then they had their annual meeting. Then we had three brilliant reports from three of the workers there, working with the senior members and then working with the young people. And it was very inspiring to hear this gospel testimony. That's what they were there for, the gospel, to make Jesus known in all of the area around the telecom tower, so that when we have a gift day in 2 weeks' time, to get behind some of the work going on in London, we're going to devote half of the proceeds of that gift day towards the clubhouse as it gets its whole fabric into shape for the 21st century. It's going to cost a lot of money, but we think that's going to be worth it. There's the gospel there. We want to get behind those people of vision well as we can, have a bumper collection on that day by God's grace. Here is Nehemiah. He was sharpened by the adversities that faced him. He was focused by his clear sense of call, and he was sustained by his prayer life with God. His prayers keep filtering through, all the way through this book. But I prayed, end of verse 9, now strengthen my hands. Verse 14, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God. And he commits his dangerous enemies in prayer for God to deal with them. He's sharpened, focused, he's sustained. But for that sense of call, he could have stayed behind at Susa all his life and not been a builder for God at all, but a very fine butler for Artaxerxes. He might even have got his name onto a piece of papyrus in later editions of palace cracklings. What a great butler. No, instead he had something that even his contemporary Plato, one of the cleverest men this world has ever seen, never had, for all his Greek intellectualism, Nehemiah had a part in the shaping of the very Bible and in the continuation of the story of God's kingdom. The threats flew about him thick and fast, and there was no let up in the pressure, not for a moment. There never is. We learn from people like Nehemiah, and we allow his experience to become part of our collective memory. Because what is happening to the church is of more importance than what is happening to any other group in the world. So we learn from these people of the past. And I close with words from the last letter ever written by the great evangelist John Wesley, 2 centuries back. His last letter was to the campaigner for the abolition of the slave trade, William Wilberforce. February 24th, 1791, the last letter. Then on March the 2nd, Wesley was gone. This is how the letter ended. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God is with you, who can be against you? Oh, be not weary in well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of his might, till even slavery, the vilest that ever saw the sun, shall vanish away before it. So what's the punchline? I am carrying on a great project. Let's pray together. Help us, O Lord, as we continue these studies in Nehemiah, to see what is the big thing that you want for our lives. And help us to pursue that greatest of all plans, centering in your kingdom, in your work, in your Son, in your gospel, and not to allow ourselves to be deflected. Help us to stand together, to build upon the heritage that we have been given in the Scriptures and in the Church. And help us to be bold, day by day, unrelenting, always. For your name's sake. Amen.